Welcome to the last lecture in this series about Einstein and the mistakes and missteps that he made throughout his life and career. In this final lecture, I'm not going to talk very much about Einstein, however, at least not directly. Instead, I'm going to focus on some of the other giants in the history of physics. Here I have in mind Johannes Kepler, Galileo Galilei, and Isaac Newton. These are figures of the absolute greatest significance. And like Einstein, their contributions have earned them each a place in the pantheon of science. And also like Einstein, each of these giants were, at some point in their life, very wrong about some of their scientific conclusions. I decided to end this series of lectures by talking about scientists other than Einstein for a number of reasons. Most of all, I decided on this topic because I think these figures are fascinating and fun to learn about. And by revisiting the history of science, we can better understand just how much the perspective and knowledge of humankind has grown and changed over the past few centuries. And like I said in Lecture 1, I think it is both interesting and important for us to consider the failures of great figures in history, including those of great scientists. And that certainly includes the failures of individuals such as Kepler, Galileo, and Newton. Understanding the failures of people such as these can help us to appreciate and remember that even the greatest of human beings is but a human being. When we imagine a person to have no flaws or to have made no mistakes, we separate them from ourselves. This can prevent us from really understanding how they thought and make it harder for us to learn from them. Another reason that I've decided to end this series on this note is that I wanted to make even more clear that Einstein was not at all alone in his failures. It's true that Einstein had his share of mistakes. But among history's greatest and boldest thinkers, the occasional mistake has been the norm and not the exception. A truly bold thinker will take chances with their ideas, while a less creative mind might instead play it safe. As you'll hear in this lecture, Galileo, Kepler, and Newton, like Einstein, were not the kind of people that played it safe with their ideas. And also like Einstein, they too made their share of mistakes and missteps. So it's my hope that after listening to this lecture, you'll see Einstein, including his mistakes, in an even more positive light. It's my sincere intent that these lectures will leave you with a greater appreciation for Einstein and his work. But if these lectures have instead left you with a negative perception of Einstein, maybe this final lecture will help to vindicate him. Not that Einstein really needs any vindication from me. In my mind, Einstein and his contributions to science deserve only the highest of praise. His mistakes do nothing to take away from that. So we'll start off this lecture with one of the most important figures in the history of astronomy, Johannes Kepler. Kepler is most famous for his three laws of planetary motion, which are still taught today in most introductory courses on astronomy and physics. The three laws of planetary motion definitely fall in the category of what Kepler got right. And before moving on to what he got wrong, let me take a minute to briefly describe Kepler's three laws. The first two laws of planetary motion were published in a book written by Kepler in 1609. The first states that planets move in elliptical orbits through the solar system, with the sun located at one focus of the ellipse. Before Kepler, most astronomers had insisted that all celestial bodies move along perfect circles. So this was an important and controversial departure from mainstream astronomical thinking. And whereas Kepler's first law tells us about the route that a given planet will take around the sun, his second law tells us about how fast they move along their elliptical orbits. In particular, the second law states that in a given interval of time, the area that's swept out by a planet's orbit is always the same. This means that when a given planet is closest to the sun, it will be moving at its fastest speed. And as the same planet moves farther from the sun, it will slow down in a manner that can be calculated using Kepler's second law. Kepler discovered his third law about a decade after the first two. This law relates two quantities: the time that it takes for a given planet to make a full orbit around the sun, and the size of that planet's orbit. In mathematical terms, it states that the square of the orbital period divided by the cube of the orbit's semi-major axis is the same for all planets. In practice, this made it possible to explain why Saturn and Jupiter move across the night sky so much more slowly than Mercury, Venus, and Mars do. Kepler's three laws were not immediately appreciated by other astronomers, but they ultimately played an enormously important role in the history of science. In particular, Isaac Newton later built upon these laws, showing that they could be derived from his universal law of gravitation. I'll return to Newton and his contributions later in this lecture. In this lecture, of course, I'm not going to focus on Kepler's three laws. Instead, I'm going to go back a little farther in time and tell you about some of the work that Kepler did during the first years of his astronomical career. Like the young Einstein, no one had much reason to expect great things from the young Johannes Kepler. For one thing, his family background was hardly the kind of place that you would look to expect to find a brilliant academic. Kepler's father was a mercenary, and he left the family when Kepler was only 5 years old. Kepler's mother, on the other hand, was at times a military camp follower, and was also known to be an herbalist and a healer. She was also widely suspected of, and later tried for, the practice of witchcraft. Needless to say, this is not the kind of family from which you would expect a great astronomer to emerge. Yet somehow, the young Kepler managed to attain a degree of education, attending school on and off throughout his childhood. Through sheer talent and willpower, he went on to attend university, where he pursued the training that would enable him to become a Lutheran minister. While at university, Kepler studied not only theology and philosophy, but also mathematics and astronomy, subjects in which he excelled. In any case, Kepler seems to have impressed his instructors. And as he was finishing his studies, he was offered a job teaching mathematics and astronomy at a Protestant school in Graz, Austria. It was in Graz that Kepler came up with what he thought was his most important contribution to science. About this, he was very wrong, but I'll come back to that in a moment. As the story is usually told, Kepler was giving a lecture on geometry one day in 1595, when this new idea suddenly unfolded before him in his mind. His lecture wasn't supposed to be about astronomy at all, but it quickly turned in that direction as Kepler's mind raced. Kepler's thinking was something like this. Picture a circle. Now surround that circle with an equilateral triangle, such that all three sides of the triangle just barely touch the edge of the circle. Now surround that triangle with a second circle, such that all three vertices of the triangle touch the edge of the outer circle. From basic geometric principles, one can work out that the circumference of these two circles have a ratio of 2:1. What struck Kepler about this result was that the size of the orbits of the planets Saturn and Jupiter exhibited approximately the same ratio, roughly 2:1 or so. So from this geometrical exercise, Kepler started to think that he might be able to explain why the orbits of the planets have the various sizes that they do. From this starting point, Kepler built up an elaborate geometrical system that he thought explained the structure of our solar system. The system was based on a set of geometrical objects that are known as the Platonic solids. A Platonic solid is a specific category of three-dimensional shapes. Every side or surface of a Platonic solid is identical. Every edge is of equal length, and every angle is of equal extent. For example, the simplest Platonic solid is a four-sided shape with an equilateral triangle on each side, a tetrahedron. The second simplest example of a Platonic solid is a six-sided cube. It turns out there are exactly five possible Platonic solids. Those are 4, 6, 8, 12, and 20 sides. Kepler's model for the solar system consisted of a sequence of alternating spheres and Platonic solids. In order for each of the five Platonic solids to appear in the system exactly once, Kepler needed 6 spheres, one for each Platonic solid and one on each end of the sequence. To Kepler, these 6 spheres represented the 6 known planets: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. The other two planets, Uranus and Neptune, weren't discovered until much later in the 18th and 19th centuries. There were a number of things to like about Kepler's system. For one thing, it appeared to explain the approximate ratios of the orbits of the 6 planets, at least for one choice of the ordering of the 5 Platonic solids. And perhaps more importantly, it provided a reason for why there appeared to be exactly 6 planets in the solar system. Before Kepler's theory, there was no answer to the question of why there were 6 planets instead of 3 or 12 or 458. Kepler thought he had changed this. Unfortunately, we now know that he did not. There's really nothing valid about Kepler's system at all. It's about as close to total nonsense as one can get. But Kepler never saw it this way. Not only did he publish a detailed description of this theory in his book, Mysterium Cosmographicum, but he continued to view it as his greatest achievement, even long after he came up with his three laws of planetary motion. But despite the fact that Kepler's system of interlocking spheres and platonic solids has nothing to do with the real solar system, I can see why such a system would be attractive to someone living in Kepler's day and age. Astrology and numerology were still seen as respectable academic disciplines at the time. Kepler himself was considered by many to be a talented astrologer. In Kepler's worldview, it just made sense that geometry could be used to reveal the number of planets. We now know that the number of planets in the solar system can't be predicted by any such first principle arguments. Instead, it's just a consequence of a long series of random events. We can't predict the number of planets any better than we can predict the number of the Earth's continents, or the fact that I have two cats in my household and I walked 6,834 steps yesterday. It just turns out that some numbers are merely a random consequence of history and circumstance. So next, I'm going to talk about another of the most important figures in the history of science. In fact, I'd argue that he's one of the most important figures in all of human history. Here I am speaking of Galileo Galilei. Galileo probably played a greater role in the birth of modern science than any other single individual. Einstein himself called Galileo the father of modern science, and that seems about right to me. During his life and career, Galileo accumulated an impressive list of scientific accomplishments. Perhaps most famous of these were his astronomical observations, which were the first that were made with a telescope. When the telescope was invented in the Netherlands in 1608, it was seen primarily as a tool for traders and merchants. It would enable them to see what ships were coming into port before other traders could. Having a telescope in 1608 was like trading in the stock market after getting a glimpse of tomorrow's newspaper. It offered a clear advantage. There were also obvious military applications for this new invention. But when Galileo first heard about this new device, he didn't see it only for its terrestrial applications. Galileo would go on to use a telescope to study the night sky with an unprecedented level of detail. The telescopes that Galileo built were significantly more powerful than the earlier Dutch models, and this allowed him to see aspects and features of the sky that had never been seen before. Among other discoveries, Galileo's telescopes enabled him to view thousands of never-before-seen stars, as well as the structure of the surface of the moon, sunspots on the surface of the sun, and the rings of Saturn. He also discovered the four largest moons of Jupiter, and observed for the first time that Venus goes through a full set of phases, similar to those exhibited by the moon. To the conventional thinking of the time, these discoveries were all very surprising and very disrupting to the status quo. According to the long-standing Ptolemaic theory of the universe, all astronomical bodies were supposed to move in perfect circles around the Earth. By this way of thinking, it was supposed to be impossible that Jupiter would have its own moons. After all, astronomical bodies were all supposed to move around the Earth, not around Jupiter. Even more upsetting was the fact that Galileo's observations of the phases of Venus left little doubt that at least some of the planets orbited the Sun and not the Earth. In particular, the fact that Venus exhibits the full range of phases from full to new means that Venus is sometimes farther away from us than the Sun, and at other times is closer to us than the Sun. If both the Sun and Venus moved in circles around the Earth, the phases of Venus would have been very different. Galileo's observations turned the consensus view of the universe on its head. But astronomy was not Galileo's only or even main area of scientific interest. He was also deeply invested in understanding the motion of bodies, including the nature of gravity. And he made important contributions to understanding of sound, temperature, and light. Perhaps even more important than any particular discovery made by Galileo was the approach that he took within his scientific work. In the context of modern science, everyone today agrees that experiment and observation is how we discriminate between competing theories. A scientific theory is treated as true, or at least as provisionally true, when it can accurately predict and explain more than other theories can. the theory of general relativity has supplanted the Newtonian theory of gravity, not because it's more beautiful or philosophically appealing or even more logical. Instead, scientists have accepted general relativity because it correctly predicts things like the orbit of Mercury and the deflection of light, whereas the Newtonian theory does not. In this sense, experiments and observations are the final arbiter of truth. But in Galileo's day, experiments and observations were generally viewed with skepticism, and they didn't yet play a major role in the execution of natural philosophy. Throughout the Middle Ages, no thinker was held in higher regard than Aristotle. Yet many of Aristotle's conclusions can be easily refuted by simple experiment or observation. For example, Aristotle thought that he had deduced on purely logical grounds that women must have fewer teeth than men do. A simple dental exam can quickly disprove this conclusion, but Aristotle seems to have never bothered to check. Unlike many of his contemporaries, Galileo would not have made this mistake. Galileo's investigations relied heavily on observations and experimental tests. To answer an outstanding question, other natural philosophers of the time would have devised proofs or offered philosophical arguments in support of their position. And at times, Galileo made these kind of arguments as well. But he also often conducted experiments and made careful observations. And these were central to how Galileo learned about the natural world. In this sense, Galileo was really the first true scientist. But even the first true scientist did not always reach correct conclusions. Galileo's mistake that I want to tell you about in this lecture has to do with his theory of the tides. Although there was no established consensus at the time about what caused the tides to rise and fall, many natural philosophers since the ancient Greeks had speculated that the tides had something to do with the moon. And about this, they were right. In fact, Kepler himself correctly argued in 1609 that it was the gravity of the moon that caused the tides. That being said, gravity still wasn't really understood, and many questions about the tides remained open. Galileo, however, just didn't buy it. To him, the idea that there was some invisible force emanating from the moon and pulling on the seas of the earth was pure superstition. To Galileo, it seemed like too much force from a source much too far away. And to him, it just didn't seem plausible. And furthermore, Galileo thought he had another and better explanation for the tides. And this explanation was directly connected with his understanding of the solar system. In particular, Galileo was convinced that the tides were caused by the motion of the Earth. And although he was right about the Earth moving, he was flatly wrong that it was this motion that causes the tides to rise and fall. At the foundation of Galileo's theory is the concept of inertia. If you pick up a bucket of water and start walking with it, the water will start to slosh around. To a degree, it depends on how fast you speed up or slow down. When you stop or start walking, the water sloshes backwards or forward as a result of this inertia. Galileo thought that the combination of the Earth's motion around the sun and its rotation around its own axis would cause the oceans to slosh around, like water in a moving bucket. The problem is that Galileo fundamentally misunderstood how inertia works. When I ride in my car, I only feel the effects of acceleration, and I don't feel any effects of speed. Similarly, the steady motion of the Earth forward through space, or around its axis, doesn't result in any time-varying force acting on the water of the Earth's oceans. Galileo's theory of the tides was based on a premature and ill-conceived notion of inertia and how it works. And he was just wrong. But Galileo, of course, did not see it that way. In fact, he thought that his explanation for the tides was so compelling that he decided to use it as part of another argument altogether. In 1632, Galileo published a book entitled A Dialogue Concerning Two Chief World Systems. In that book, he argued that the Earth was in orbit around the sun, a very controversial and dangerous opinion to express at the time. In this book, Galileo argued that the planets of the solar system orbit around the sun and not around the Earth. In support of this, he made many valid arguments, including those based on his telescopic observations of Jupiter's moons and the phases of Venus. But alongside these perfectly valid arguments were other deeply flawed arguments, based mostly on Galileo's faulty theory of the tides. Galileo clearly thought that these arguments were central to his case, In fact, he originally wanted to name the book A Dialogue on the Tides. About the basic structure of the solar system, Galileo, of course, turned out to be correct, despite the fact that many of his arguments were based on a misunderstanding of how the tides function. But the flawed science found in parts of Galileo's book turned out to be the least of his problems. In the year following the publication of this book, the Inquisition declared Galileo to be vehemently suspect of heresy. The Inquisition threatened him with torture and death unless he recanted his views. So, of course, he did. Furthermore, not only was this book itself banned, but so was everything else that Galileo had ever written, or would ever write in the future. And Galileo spent the rest of his life under house arrest. The last of the three scientific giants that I'll talk about in this lecture is none other than the great Isaac Newton. Like Galileo, Newton is one of the most important figures in all of human history. Many of his most important contributions are contained in his book, The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, which is usually simply referred to as the Principia. The Principia was published in 1687, and it describes the very basis and foundation of classical physics, including things like the law of universal gravitation and Newton's three laws of motion. Among other things, Newton demonstrated in this book that these principles could be used to derive Kepler's three laws of planetary motion. In other words, he showed that the planets move in the way that they do because of the force of gravity. The same force that pulls us downward also keeps the planets in their orbits. Newton's list of accomplishments is far too long for me to describe here, but among other things, it includes substantial contributions to the science of light, sound, and heat. He also invented the mathematics that is now known as calculus, along with Gottfried Leibniz, who independently developed it around the same time. Compared to Newton's contributions and accomplishments, the mistake that I'm going to talk about might seem a little insignificant, but it's an interesting one, and besides, Newton didn't give me many mistakes to pick from, so I don't have many other options here. Like with Kepler and Galileo, the issue at hand has to do with the solar system and the motion of the planets. But a lot had been learned between the early 1600s, when Kepler and Galileo were making their contributions, and the late 1600s, when Newton was making his. The Principia contains all of the principles, laws, and equations that one would need to accurately describe the motion of the planets, moons, comets, and all the other bodies that are found throughout the solar system. The understanding of celestial mechanics as established by Newton would remain basically unchanged for over 200 years, until Einstein himself refined it with the introduction of the theory of general relativity. So Newton had all of the tools that he needed to explain and calculate the motion of the planets. But in practice, these calculations are not always easy to carry out. It's not very hard to use these equations to calculate the motion of a single planet in orbit around a single star, but more complex situations can be much more difficult. This is because a given planet doesn't only feel the gravitational pull from the sun. Each planet also experiences a gentle gravitational tug from each of the other planets. Although in terms of gravity, the planets play a very secondary role compared to that of the sun, Newton worried that perhaps the planets could not be entirely ignored. In particular, he worried that the planets might pull on each other in such a way that would occasionally throw one or more of the planets off of their orbit, perhaps sending it hurling into another planet, or even into the sun. Or perhaps a planet might be expelled from the solar system entirely. In light of these concerns, Newton found himself asking the following question. If planetary orbits are so unstable, why are there still so many planets orbiting the sun? His response to this conundrum tells us more about his worldview and his place in time than it does about the dynamics of the solar system. A modern scientist facing an analogous problem would go back through their equations, revisit their assumptions, and consider what physical forces or mechanisms might impact the question at hand. But Newton wasn't a modern scientist. Instead, he was something like a hybrid of a scientist and a philosopher or theologian from the Middle Ages. So instead of searching for or demanding a physical explanation, Newton solved this problem by simply invoking the intervention of God. What Newton seems to have had in mind was a scenario in which the planets usually obey the well-defined laws of motion, as he laid out in the Principia. But if a planet was ever thrown too far off its course, God would step in and restore the long-standing order of the solar system. In other words, in order to explain the stability of the solar system, Newton relied on the occasional miracle. I've sometimes wondered what other scientists and natural philosophers at the time thought about Newton's decision to invoke the direct intervention of God. It's known that Leibniz objected to this reliance on divine intervention, but I'm not sure how widespread this sentiment was at the time. If a scientist today were discussing a theory that had some lingering problems or unanswered questions, they would probably acknowledge that the problems existed and perhaps suggest that with further investigation, these problems might be resolved. But Newton, in facing the apparent instability of the solar system, instead declared a concrete solution, albeit a miraculous and supernatural one. Over the centuries, many theists have invoked this kind of God of the Gaps explanation in an effort to resolve the various unanswered questions that they faced. But the problem with this kind of argument is that ultimately these kinds of outstanding issues usually do get solved and explained. And when that happens, the role of divine intervention evaporates. This is exactly what happened in the case of the stability of the solar system. About a century after Newton published the Principia, the French astronomer and mathematician Pierre-Simon Laplace addressed this question directly and demonstrated with mathematical rigor that the solar system is quite stable over very long periods of time. Laplace didn't necessarily find that planetary orbits are stable indefinitely, but in the case of our solar system, they do appear to be stable over many millions, if not billions, of years. There is an often told, although probably ahistorical, story about Laplace and the time that he gave a copy of his book to his friend Napoleon Bonaparte. In the story, Napoleon asks Laplace about the role that God plays in maintaining the order of the solar system. In response, Laplace simply replies, "I have no need of that hypothesis." So we have come to the end of this lecture and to the end of this series of lectures. I hope you've enjoyed them as much as I've enjoyed preparing and presenting them. Throughout most of my adult life, I've thought of Einstein as one of the most fascinating people that I've ever read about or studied. His ideas were brilliant and revolutionary. And as we've discussed in these lectures, his ideas were also sometimes wrong. But in this, Einstein is far from alone. Even the greatest of scientists have made their share of mistakes. In this lecture, I've talked about three examples of great scientists who got something very wrong. This included Kepler and his ridiculous geometrical theory of the solar system, Galileo and his misguided theory of the tides, and lastly, Newton and his unnecessary reliance on divine intervention in order to save the solar system from collapse. In light of these examples, Einstein seems to be in some good company. After all, Kepler, Galileo, Newton, and Einstein are each among the most important and influential figures in the history of science. And they each deserve all of the credit that they've been given. But this does not mean that they were without their failures, errors, and mistakes. And if their failures were sometimes greater than those of other scientists, this was in part true because their ideas and opinions were so much more bold. The philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn, famously argued that science progresses through periods of what he called normal science, punctuated by occasional periods of disruption, in which existing paradigms are overturned. During periods of normal science, scientists work to refine and improve their understanding of the theories at hand. They conduct increasingly precise experiments and catalog new data, all while keeping the existing paradigm in place. During periods such as these, there is little room for wild speculation or for bold hypothesizing. Careful deliberation is needed with an eye towards maximal accuracy and precision. But Einstein, Newton, Kepler, and Galileo were not conducting normal science. They did wildly speculate, and they did boldly hypothesize. Were they always right? No, far from it. But they did overturn many of the paradigms of their day. Einstein was a brilliant and bold visionary, and he was responsible for many of the greatest breakthroughs in the history of science. And although scientifically speaking, Einstein didn't have a perfect batting average, he did hit far more home runs than just about anyone else. And for that, he will be remembered for millennia to come.